David Experiences the San Francisco Earthquake, written by Linda Sibley. Chapter 1. Home Alone.
"This isn't fair," Jenny complained. "Why do I have to stay with Grandma? David gets to stay home by himself."
"Someday, when you're older, you can stay home too," Mom said patiently. "Besides," I said, "it's just for 2 days."
"Humph,"
Jenny pouted and turned away. I tried to make it sound unimportant, but the truth was that I was very proud of myself. I was being left in charge of the house for 2 whole days. Mom and Dad were spending the weekend at their college reunion. "David, you're the man of the house now," Dad said. He patted me on the back. My chest swelled with pride at his words. Jenny only got angrier. She stormed out of the front door.
"Just make sure you get all the chores done," Mom reminded me. I left the list on the kitchen table.
"No problem, Mom," I reassured her. "Don't worry about a thing."
"We won't worry," Mom smiled. "We trust you, David."
"We'll be back home tomorrow after dinner," Dad informed me. "You have our number. Call if you need us."
"Okay, Dad," I said. I pushed them both out the door. "You've told me that 100 times.
Finally, they were out the door. I stood at the window and watched them drive away. I wanted to make sure they were really gone. Freedom! I had the whole house to myself. I could do anything I wanted. I decided to check out the kitchen first. I wanted to make sure Mom had stocked the refrigerator before she'd left. When I opened the refrigerator door, the light blinked on to reveal my favorites. I found a 1/2 gallon of chocolate milk, 2 jars of peanut butter and jelly, and a huge jar of dill pickles. I poured a big glass of chocolate milk. Then I sat at the table to read my list of jobs. It didn't look too bad. If I worked fast, I could breeze through them in a couple of hours. Then I'd be free to try my new computer game. I'd save money for a month to buy it. My plan was to master it before my friends Jeff and Ryan discovered I'd bought it. The first chores on the list were to sweep out the garage and empty the trash. I accomplished them quickly. Next, I had to water the roses and mow the lawn. It wasn't long before I was crossing them off my list, too. At that point, there were only a few jobs left. The first one was to clean my room. Ugh, I always hated that job. I trudged up the stairs and threw open the door. Even I had to admit it was a disaster area. It was a wonder I had any clothes to wear. Several pairs of dirty jeans were stuffed under the bed. An assortment of shirts and underwear had been tossed on the floor. I had slam-dunked some dirty socks into the trash can. My football jersey was hanging from the light fixture on the ceiling. Mom commonly referred to my room as the site of World War III. Today, I would have probably had to agree with her. I decided to leave the chore for last. The next job involved some reference books. Mom used them to teach her college history class. I was supposed to unpack the boxes of books and put them on the bookshelves in the office. I clicked on the light in the office. 3 boxes of books lay on the floor. This would be easy. I stacked the books high in my arms to cut down on trips. I wished Jeannie, this girl from school, was there to see me. Maybe she'd be impressed by my strength. I didn't seem to be able to impress her any other way. I had tried hard over the past few weeks, but so far she'd barely noticed me. I made the second stack of books a little too high. The top book slid off and hit me right on my big toe. I jumped around on the other foot, moaning in pain. Then more books began to fall. Finally, I just dropped the rest of the stack. Then I collapsed on the floor to nurse my sore toe. Gradually, the pain lessened. I looked at the pile of books around me. I picked up the book that was the cause of my injury. I figured it was probably some boring book about the Revolutionary War. To my surprise, the book was all about San Francisco, California. It contained pictures from the 1800s as well as modern day. I smiled as I turned the pages and studied the pictures. Suddenly, I could imagine Tony Giovanni's face. He had been such a good friend when my family and I had traveled back to the Chicago World's Fair. We'd gone there in the time machine my grandpa had invented. Together, we formed a group with some other guys who had just arrived in America. They loved it when I taught them American words like awesome and chill. Tony and his mother even gave my family a place to stay for a few days. I thought about how Tony had longed to move to California with his mother. I chuckled when I recalled his big dream. He had hoped to be the mayor of San Francisco someday. I thumbed through the pages of the book. I stopped to read a chapter that looked interesting. It was about the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. The quake had measured 8.3 on the Richter scale. The ground had broken apart for 270 miles along the San Andreas Fault. Pages and pages of pictures showed damage. Hundreds of people had died in the earthquake. Many others were left homeless. Pictures showed giant crevices that snaked across the ground. Buildings had tumbled onto one another. They looked like dominoes that had been carefully set in a row, then toppled. As I scanned the pages, my eyes settled on the heading, "Election for Mayor Halted." I was very drawn to the page, like a magnet. I read every word. There had been an upcoming election for mayor. It was supposed to have been held the week following the earthquake. It was delayed because one of the candidates was killed in the quake. The current mayor had remained in his position until an election could be held. My eyes scanned the page quickly. I searched for the name of the other candidate. I felt my heart thumping loudly in my chest as I read the words. Antonio Giovanni, his mother Frances, his wife Angelina, and his young son Antonio Jr. were killed during the earthquake. Their home collapsed on them as they slept. Mr. Giovanni was well-loved and had many supporters. Experts predicted he would have easily won the election. My eyes filled with tears. This couldn't be. Tony had been so close to realizing his dream. He'd made it to California and started a family. He had been about to become mayor. What a cruel blow. I shoved the book away from me. I didn't want to look at it anymore. It was just too painful to know that Tony's life had ended that way. I wished I'd never found the book. Then I began to wonder about the coincidence. Maybe I was supposed to find it. After all, I did have the means to prevent it. I could travel back in time and save Tony and his family. My thoughts turned to Mom and her frequent warnings. She had cautioned us that we should never do anything to change the course of history. I knew I couldn't tell my parents about my plans. They would stop me from going. But they weren't around. I could arrive the day before the earthquake, warn Tony, and get back home before my parents returned. They'd never know I'd left. I convinced myself that I could do it. I had to do it for Tony. Chapter 2. A Terrifying Arrival. My mind was racing as I rushed up the stairs. I fumbled through the hall closet. I quickly grabbed the clothes from our trip to Chicago in 1893. I had grown a little taller, so I was forced to wear Dad's clothes. I didn't care that they were big and looked silly. I shoved them into my duffel bag. I would change at Grandma's house. I locked the front door as I left. I thought of the chores I'd left unfinished. I reassured myself that I would be back before Mom and Dad got home. Then I'd finish my chores. They'd never even realize I'd been gone. Of course, I would probably blurt out the whole story once they got home. But it wouldn't matter then. Tony and his family would have been rescued, and I would have returned safely. I congratulated myself on such a foolproof plan. It was a long walk to Grandma's house. Her green sedan was in the driveway when I arrived. That meant she and Jenny were in the house. Suddenly, I was filled with guilt. Maybe I should let them know what I was doing. After all, I didn't want them to worry about me. But if I told them, they would try to stop me. I turned and looked at the garage. I knew the time machine was waiting. I dismissed my guilty feelings and quietly sneaked into the garage. I used the spare key to the side door. I changed into my 1893 clothes quickly. I shoved the bag with my other clothes in a corner. Then I carefully uncovered Grandpa's time machine. I allowed the dust to settle around it. There it stood, in all its beauty. Grandpa had been such a clever man to have invented it. It continued to amaze me every time I saw it. I took a rag from the shelf and polished the stainless steel outside. The inside panels and the dials were still clean and shiny. I had watched Dad each time he set the dials for our trips. I was confident that I could set them correctly. Slowly, I turned the first dial. I set the time machine to deliver me to San Francisco, California. I would arrive at 9 a.m. on April 17th, 1906. I set my return for 3 a.m. on April 18, 1906. I knew the earthquake would occur at 5:12 a.m. on Wednesday, April 18. I would have 18 hours to find Tony, warn him, and return. I was sure I could do it. Once the dials were set, I put my finger on the control button. I hesitated, only for a moment. Then I slowly pushed it. My journey began. I was relieved to feel the usual loss of gravity. When I opened my eyes, I found lights and pictures flashing around me. The ride felt as wild and crazy as always. I was encouraged that everything was working normally. Soon, the pictures began to fade. The lights dim, and the ride slowed. Suddenly, everything was black. I kept blinking to see if my eyes would clear. It should be 9 o'clock in the morning. Where was the sun? My eyes began to slowly adjust to the darkness. Then I realized I was standing on a dimly lit street. I could make out some signs on the buildings, but I couldn't read them. They weren't written in English. Something was wrong. A few people walked down the street. They were dressed differently than I was and looked Asian. They stared at me as if I were the odd one. Then they started talking to one another in a foreign language. A sense of panic began to creep over me. My stomach felt sick. My head was spinning and my hands were sweaty. I had done something wrong. I wasn't even in the United States. As I walked, I tried to calm down. I thought about the steps I had taken when setting the time machine. I was positive I had set it for San Francisco, California. I passed a little old man who was sweeping the sidewalk in front of a store. I asked him what town we were in. He swung his broom at me as if trying to sweep me away. He was rattling angrily in a language I'd never heard. I felt as if I were caught up in some kind of nightmare. I'd always thought of myself as pretty tough, but at that moment I was close to tears. Then a voice came from behind me, in English. I turned to see a boy who looked about 12 or 13 years old. He had on dark baggy pants and a light-colored jacket. He wore a white cap that fit his head tightly with a black button on top. His black hair was pulled to the back in one long braid that reached to his waist. "Who are you looking for?" he asked. "You speak English?" I asked in shock. "Of course," he said, laughing. I knew I would look like an idiot, but I had to ask. "Where am I?" I asked quietly. "You don't know where you are?" asked the boy. "But how did you get here?" "I'm not sure," I lied. "Please, just tell me where I am." "I'm sure you're not where you wish to be," he said, smiling. "You're in Chinatown." "Chinatown?" I asked in disbelief. "Where do you wish to be?" he asked. "I want to be in San Francisco, California," I said weakly. "But you are in San Francisco, California," he said. "Chinatown is part of San Francisco." "What?" I asked in astonishment. "Come with me," he said. He led me down the road. As we turned the corner, I saw the lights of the city spread out around me. "This is San Francisco," he said. He waved his arm over the area. Relief flooded over me. Then I remembered my second problem. "What time is it?" I asked. I knew I wasn't going to like the answer.
"It's around 9, he answered. I didn't need to ask if it was a.m. or p.m. It was clear that I had made a mistake. I had set the machine to arrive at 9 p.m.
I dropped to the edge of the wooden sidewalk and put my hands to my head. This meant I didn't have 18 hours to find Tony. Instead, I only had 6 hours.
"Are you all right?" he asked.
He continued to stand in front of me. He patiently waited for me to speak.
"If you're sick, I can get you some of my grandmother's herbal tea," he said with concern.
"I'm okay," I mumbled.
"Why have you come to San Francisco?" he asked.
"To visit a friend," I answered.
"Where does he live?"
"I'm not sure," I said.
"Then how will you find him?" he asked.
My frustration got the best of me. I stood up angrily and faced him.
"Why do you have so many questions to ask?" I yelled. "Would you just give me a minute?"
He didn't seem annoyed with my bad mood. He waited quietly while I paced.
"I need to find my friend Tony," he declared. "And I need to find him fast. I'm not sure where he lives. I do know he wanted to be a fisherman, so there's a good chance he'll be living close to the water."
"Then the first place to look is Fisherman's Wharf," the boy said eagerly.
I looked out over the city. It was spread out in all directions. I realized that finding Tony was going to be much harder than I'd imagined. I didn't have any idea where to start looking.
"Can you point me in the right direction?" I asked.
"I'll take you there," he said, grinning. He stood there smiling at me. I felt guilty. He was eager to help, and I had been rude.
"That would be great," I smiled in return.
"My name is David Smithers," I said. I reached to shake his hand.
"My name is Chin Lee Wang," he said, shaking my hand.
"Welcome to San Francisco." Chapter 3. The Search Begins. It was difficult to keep up with Chin Lee. He quickly guided me through the back streets of San Francisco. I was amazed that his short legs could walk so fast. He was silent as we walked. It gave me time to think about the mess I was in. Nothing seemed to be going as I had planned. I had very little time to find Tony now. It would be especially hard in such a large city. And I had to be back in Chinatown at 3 a.m. tomorrow to return home. I thought it through and came to a decision. I would have to concentrate on Tony and his family first. Then I would worry about myself later. The farther Chin Lee went, the faster he walked. I was huffing and puffing behind him.
"How much further?" I asked breathlessly.
"The bay is around the corner," he answered. Just then, I heard the lonesome chimes of a nearby tower clock. I counted along as it struck 10 times. An hour had already passed. This meant that I had only 5 hours before I had to return. We approached Fisherman's Wharf. A long row of docks stretched before us. I tried not to panic when I saw hundreds of boats anchored in the bay. How would I ever find Tony?
"Okay, Chin Lee," I said. "My friend's name is Tony Giovanni."
"A man named Antonio Giovanni is running for mayor," Chin Lee said.
"Is that the same man?"
"Yes," I almost shouted with excitement. "Do you know where he lives?"
"I'm sorry," he said quietly. "I don't know where he lives."
"That's okay," I said. I tried to hide my disappointment. "But I have to find him in the next couple of hours. It's a matter of life and death."
Chin Lee nodded in agreement. His eyes were wide open.
"What's the fastest way to find him?" I asked.
"Some fishermen might still be working on their boats at this hour," he suggested. "We can ask them. They'll know if he's a fisherman from around here."
I agreed, and we started down the nearest dock. I soon found that I wasn't dressed for an evening on the docks. My light shirt offered little warmth from the cold wind blowing across the bay. Only a few fishermen were out so late. Most of them had finished cleaning their boats and gone in for the night. A group of men sat around an old barrel on the dock. They were talking and laughing loudly as they played cards. I stared toward them. Chin Lee grabbed my arm.
"Don't bother them," he warned.
They won't help you anyway. I started to heed his warning and turn away. But then I squared my shoulders and walked closer to them. I wasn't going to give up so easily. I stood quietly and watched them for a minute. Finally, I got the nerve to speak. "Excuse me, gentlemen," I said boldly. They continued their game and ignored me. "Excuse me, gentlemen," I repeated a little louder. At this, several of the men turned and looked at me. When I saw their faces, I wish I'd listened to Chin Lee. They were rough-looking and unshaven. They all had scowls on their faces. They looked like they could be the crew of a pirate ship.
"What did you say, boy?"
yelled one of the men. My knees were shaking as I took a step closer.
"I was just wondering if you knew anyone named Tony Giovanni," I said.
"You're bothering us just to ask that?" shouted another one of them. He stood up. He was big, ugly, and probably had not bathed in a year.
Yes, sir, I said, swallowing hard.
By this time, I was quivering in my boots. I tried to assure myself it was from the cold wind, but the fact was, I was scared to death.
"Get out of here,"
the man yelled. He stamped his foot on the wooden dock. "And don't bother us again." I knew there were times in life when I should stand up to things I feared, but I decided this wasn't one of them. I turned and ran as fast as I could with Chin Lee in the lead. I could hear the men laughing loudly. When we were far enough away, we stopped to catch our breath. "I tried to tell you," Chin Lee said. "Okay," I agreed. "I guess you were right. Now, follow me." We walked down to the next pier. I watched the gentle swells of the bay. The red and green running lights on the anchored boats bobbed up and down in the water. It was such a peaceful scene. It was difficult to believe an earthquake was so near. We continued searching the docks. Soon, we found a young fisherman cleaning his nets.
"Sir," I called to him, "I'm looking for a friend of mine. Can you help me?"
"I'll try," he offered. "Who is it?"
"His name is Tony Giovanni," I said. "I think he's a fisherman around here."
"Yes," he smiled. "I know Antonio." I was so relieved. Finally, we had a lead on Tony. "He's a fisherman and a friend of mine," he said. "His boat is anchored at the end of the dock."
"Thank you very much," I yelled as I turned to leave.
"But if you're looking for him, he's not there," the fisherman called after me.
"Where is he?"
I asked anxiously. "He took his wife and mother to the opera tonight," he answered.
"The opera?" I asked in disbelief. It was hard to imagine the Tony I had known going to the opera.
Then I remembered that Tony was 13 years older now. He would have changed, but I still couldn't imagine him going to the opera.
"Oh, yes," he assured me. "The famous tenor Enrico Caruso is performing there tonight."
"Do you know where the opera is?" I asked Chin Lee.
"Yes," he said. "I can take you there, but it's too far to walk. We need to find a cable car." Chin Lee raced ahead of me again. After a few blocks, we spotted a cable car. We sprinted toward it and hopped on. I tried to catch the sights of the city as we passed, but I was too anxious to focus on much.
"The opera house isn't far," Chin Lee said after a while.
"The opera should be over before midnight. We can catch him when he comes out." Another hour must have passed by now. I resisted the urge to check my watch. I was trying to keep it hidden under the long sleeves of Dad's shirt. Thoughts of home flooded my mind. I began to doubt that it had been a good idea to come. What had I gotten myself into? Then I thought about Tony. He and his family would die if I didn't help them. I shook off my frustration and tried to enjoy the ride. Finally, we arrived at the Grand Opera House. A large circle drive curved in front of the theater. Shiny black carriages were waiting in a long row. The drivers were dressed in black suits and top hats. They were gathered in groups around the carriages.
"We've arrived in time," Chin Lee announced. Let's move up closer so we can see, I said. I stepped forward.
No,
Chin Li commanded. He yanked me back.
What's wrong?
I asked, annoyed.
Don't get closer, he warned. They'll just yell at you to get back.
No, they won't, I insisted. Just wait here.
I started walking across the lawn to the driveway. One of the drivers turned in my direction. He immediately grabbed his horsewhip and cracked it high in the air.
Don't come any closer or I'll use this whip on you, boy, he yelled.
But sir, I pleaded, I just wanted to ask you.
This time, he cracked the whip only a few feet from my head.
We'll have no thieves and beggars hanging around here, he shouted.
What a jerk, I mumbled as I walked back to Chin Li.
What's his problem? I asked.
Why did you try that? He asked with a look of amazement. You know you're not welcome here.
No, I don't know that, I said angrily.
Why does he assume we are beggars and thieves?
He looked at me in disbelief for a moment.
Because you're black, and I'm Chinese, he said softly.
Chapter 4. Close, but yet so far. I stared at Chin Li in shock.
You're saying we're being chased off by everyone because I'm black and you're Chinese? I asked.
Of course, he answered. Then he looked at me curiously and said, You must live very far away. I didn't answer him. I just looked at the ground to hide my frustration. Then a deep sadness settled over me. It was the same sadness I always felt when I was rejected because of my skin color.
Where do you live?
Chin Li was asking.
I live a long way from here, I said quietly.
People there don't treat you badly? He asked.
He looked amazed at the idea.
Not too often, I said.
I want to live where you live, Chin Li smiled. Will you take me there?
I'm sorry, I said slowly. I can't take you there. It's too far away.
Oh, he said softly.
I really would if I could, I tried to convince him. I just can't.
It's all right, he said. I couldn't leave my grandmother anyway.
What about your parents? I asked.
My parents died when I was 2 years old, he said sadly. They died from the bubonic plague.
I'm sorry, I said.
And what about your grandmother? Isn't she going to worry about you tonight?
Yes, she might worry, he said.
Then maybe you should go home, I suggested. I don't want to get you in trouble. I can wait for Tony myself.
No, I'll stay a little longer, he said. I'll get home safely.
Why does everyone around here treat Chinese people so badly? I asked.
I don't know, he said. More than 30,000 Chinese live in Chinatown now, but we're treated without respect. We can't go to school, and our parents can't find jobs.
People say it's because we have yellow skin, he continued.
I don't know why the color of a person's skin matters. My grandmother says it's the heart that matters.
Your grandmother is right, I assured him.
At that moment, people began to stream out of the theater. The drivers jumped to attention next to their rigs. I watched as they opened the doors of their carriages. They helped the ladies in their fancy dresses step into the carriages. I searched the crowd for faces. I was so desperate to find Tony.
I haven't seen him in a long time, I explained. I might not recognize him. Just look for a young man with his wife and mother.
I carefully inched my way closer. I was afraid we would be noticed and lose any chance of finding him. Then I saw a man who looked like an older version of young Tony. A beautiful woman with long dark hair stood by his side. Standing next to her was Tony's mother, Frances. I recognized her right away. She looked just the same.
There they are! I screamed to Chin Li. Their carriage is leaving!
We can follow the carriage until they're away from the theater, Chin Li instructed. Then we'll stop them. We darted around the crowd quickly and tried to keep the carriage in sight.
It wasn't easy because every carriage looked alike. We followed them for several blocks. They stopped in front of a fancy restaurant. We ran hard to catch up, but we didn't make it. They were already inside when we arrived. We watched Tony and the two women through the restaurant's front windows. They were seated at a table in the back of the room. It was frustrating to see Tony so close and not be able to get to him. "We can't go in there," Chin Lee warned. This time, I didn't argue with him. We moved to the corner of the building. We were careful to stay away from the doorman. We crouched at the corner of the window and watched Tony and his family. They were talking and laughing. It was easy to see that Tony was very happy. He had obviously done well in California. He had a lovely young wife and a new son. His dream of becoming mayor was almost a reality. I turned to whisper something to Chin Lee. But instead of finding Chin Lee, I saw a large pair of black boots. My eyes scanned upward until I was looking into the growling face of a burly policeman. He already had hold of Chin Lee's arm. He grabbed the collar of my shirt. "Let me go," I demanded. "We weren't doing anything wrong." "That's only because I caught you before you could do something wrong," growled the officer. "You no good kids are always hanging around here. I'm going to put a stop to it."
"You don't understand," I pleaded. "I'm a friend of Antonio Giovanni."
He stopped and looked at me for a minute. Then he began to laugh.
"It's true," I insisted. "Just call him out here and ask him."
"I will not bother such an important man by asking him such a ridiculous question," he barked. "A friend of Antonio Giovanni," he snorted and continued to laugh.
He dragged us backwards. I fought to pull away from his grip. Chin Lee was not resisting him at all. That made me even angrier.
"Chin Lee, do something," I ordered in frustration.
"It's no use," he said quietly. "Just do as he says." A young officer arrived and held open the door of a wagon. It looked like a big wooden box. It was almost completely closed in. The two small windows were covered with thick black bars. The older officer pushed us roughly into the wagon. He slammed the door. Inside, it was dark and smelled like rotten eggs.
"Chin Lee," I called out in the darkness. "What's happening to us?"
"They'll take us to the jailhouse," he said calmly. "They'll hold us overnight and let us go in the morning."
"In the morning?" I shouted. "I have to get out of here now."
I heard the officer crack his whip over the horses. The wagon jerked forward. I could only think of how I was being driven further away from Tony. I knew my chance of finding him again was almost zilch. I sank into the corner of the wagon in despair. I had done everything wrong. First of all, I hadn't set the time machine right. That mistake had caused me to arrive 12 hours late. Next, I didn't have a clue where Tony lived. Then, when I finally found him after the opera, I couldn't catch up with him. Finally, I had been arrested. Now I was being driven all over San Francisco, wasting precious time. And then there was my really big problem. I was supposed to return home at 3 a.m. There was no way I could do that now. Even if I were free, I couldn't make it to Chinatown on time. I wasn't even sure where I was supposed to return from anyway. Because of my confusion when I arrived, I hadn't paid attention. The terrifying reality was I was going to miss my ride back home. I would be stuck in the past forever. I drew my knees up to my chest and rested my head on them. I was grateful for the darkness when I felt tears fill my eyes. I longed to be back home watching television or playing on the computer. Even cleaning my room sounded good to me now. My mouth watered for a pickle and a glass of chocolate milk. I remembered my parents' faces when they had hugged me goodbye. Mom's words played over and over in my head. "We trust you, David. We trust you, David." The wagon rocked as it traveled down the cobblestone streets. I was mentally and physically exhausted.
The motion of the wagon made me sleepy. The ride stopped just as I was about to doze off.
Chin Li, I said in the darkness, why have we stopped?
They're probably making another arrest, Chin Li said sleepily. We'll be moving again in a few minutes. I listened as a lonely church bell rang in the distance. I strained to hear and counted each toll. 1, 2, 3, 4. It was 4 in the morning. I knew there was no chance of returning home now. I would be stuck here forever. I also knew the earthquake would still occur at 5:12. That meant I still had 1 hour and 12 minutes to warn Tony. Suddenly, I was filled with new determination. I had set out to rescue Tony, and that's what I was going to do. Chapter 5. Earthquake. I began to beat wildly on the side of the wagon.
Let me out of here, I shouted.
David, Chin Li warned, you must calm down. I pulled on the bars of the window. They wouldn't budge. I continued to shout. I banged on the sides of the wagon and even kicked the floor. Suddenly, a small window slid open in front of the wagon. The young officer yelled at me to be quiet.
You have to help me, I pleaded. Please listen to me.
What is it?
He asked angrily.
Antonio Giovanni is really a friend of mine, I started. I knew him in Chicago several years ago.
The officer was quiet. I continued.
He and his family are in danger, I said. I need to warn him. If I don't, they'll all be killed in the next few hours.
How do you know this? The officer asked.
I don't have time to explain, I said. You just have to trust me.
How do you know Tony lived in Chicago?
The officer asked curiously. I noticed that the officer called Antonio Tony, and he knew that Tony had lived in Chicago. The officer must know him.
Do you know Tony?
I said excitedly.
If you do, then you must know that he and his parents moved from Italy to Chicago. His father was killed shortly after they arrived in America. He and his mother ran a tenement in Chicago for a few years. Tony worked at the Chicago World's Fair. His mother worked at the University of Chicago.
My heart sank as the little window slid closed again. But a moment later, the back door of the wagon swung open.
Get out, he said, quickly, before Officer Quinn returns.
He didn't have to tell us twice. Chin Li and I were out of the wagon in a flash. The cool night air felt great after being locked up. The officer gave us directions to Tony's house. Luckily, it wasn't too far.
Thank you so much, I said gratefully. I'll be sure to tell Tony you helped me.
I had already turned to leave when I stopped myself. I knew there was something else I had to do.
There will be a terrible earthquake at 5:12 this morning, I told the officer. Save your family and friends if you can. Get them out of their homes.
He was so stunned that he didn't speak. I turned away and ran to find Tony. I glanced back at the officer. He was still standing there in shock. I just hope he believed me.
Chin Li started to run alongside me, but I stopped suddenly and grabbed his shoulders. I looked him straight in the eye.
Chin Li, I said seriously, you must go home now and find your grandmother. There isn't much time left.
You mean there really is going to be an earthquake?
He asked in astonishment.
Yes, Chin Li, I told him, and it will be a bad one. You must take your grandmother somewhere safe.
Chin Li turned and looked towards Chinatown.
I don't understand how you know this, he said, staring at me. But I believe you. I'll do as you say.
He bowed politely from the waist. Then he turned and ran as fast as his feet would carry him. I ran towards Tony's house with all my strength. My breathing was fast and hard. I could feel my heart pounding in my chest. I finally reached Tony's house. Relief flooded over me. I stopped in the street and leaned over with my hands on my knees. I needed a minute to catch my breath. The sun was just beginning to rise. The sky was clear blue. It promised to be a beautiful day.
There was no way to know the danger was so near. In the distance, I heard dogs howling. Then I realized they were howling all over town. As if they were joining in a song, birds began chirping noisily. A horse that was tied in front of a neighboring house began to neigh loudly and stomp his feet. It was as if the animals were announcing the arrival of the earthquake. They must have sensed it was coming. Perhaps they could even feel the rumblings deep underground. I gathered my strength and ran up the stairs of Tony's front porch. I banged loudly on the door and called his name. I heard a noise inside the house and began to pound even louder. The door finally swung open. Tony's angry face greeted me. But his anger melted away when he stared at me. "David?" he asked softly. "Is that you?" "Yes, Tony," I said excitedly. "It's me. I've been looking for you everywhere." I never expected to see you again," he stuttered. He looked as if he were in a trance as he stood staring at me. I was frustrated that he was not reacting quickly enough. Time was too precious to waste now. We had to get moving. "Tony," I yelled, "listen to me. I've come to warn you." "What?" he stammered. "There's going to be an earthquake at any moment," I shrieked. "Get your family out of the house. If you don't, they'll be killed." "An earthquake?" he asked, snapping out of his trance. "Hurry up," I demanded. I pushed my way past him and into his house. "Where are they?" "Angelina is in the front room, there," he pointed. "My mother and Antonio Jr. are upstairs." "Mrs. Giovanni," I shouted up the stairs. "Angelina," Tony began yelling. "Angelina, wake up." Tony's mother appeared at the top of the stairs. She was carrying the baby, who was crying loudly. "Antonio, what's happening?" she cried. "Get out of the house," he yelled. "Take the baby and go outside." At that point, Angelina appeared at the bedroom door. Without a word, Tony grabbed her and whisked her to the front door. "Antonio," she screamed, "what are you doing?" "There's no time to explain," he said. He pushed her outside. His mother was making her way down the stairs with the baby. As she neared Tony, he reached up and took the baby from her arms. I stepped forward to help his mother. She looked at me strangely. Suddenly, I froze when I heard a deep roaring sound beneath my feet. I could imagine the earth's floor moving and breaking apart. Tons of rocks were being shifted about under the earth. The earthquake had begun. Tony ran out of the front door with the baby. His mother followed closely behind them. I could see the open door in front of me. Only two more steps, and I would be out of the house safely. But before I could reach the door, I felt a violent jerking motion. The floor began to vibrate with tremendous force. I was thrown to the ground. Then the walls of the house began to creak as they swayed back and forth. I was tossed about on the floor. I could hear glass breaking throughout the house. I saw the bricks from the fireplace crash to the floor in the next room. Furniture was toppling over and splintering into little pieces. Big sections of plaster were falling from the ceiling. They created clouds of dust when they hit the floor. The front door was so close, but no matter how hard I struggled, I couldn't reach it. Finally, with one loud groan, the house began to give way. Instinctively, I threw my hands up to cover my head as the ceiling crashed down on top of me. Chapter 6. Destruction Beyond Belief. Somewhere in the distance, I could hear voices calling my name. I didn't know if I was dreaming or if the voices were real. Slowly, my head began to clear. I realized I was completely covered with debris. I couldn't move any part of my body. When I tried, I hurt all over. Just the thought of being pinned under the collapsed house made me panic. I hated the feeling of being closed in. The fact that it was dark under there didn't help either. The voices gradually became louder. I tried to stay calm. I reminded myself that Tony would get me out. "David!" Tony was calling. "Can you hear me, David?" I tried to answer, but I couldn't. My mouth was dry, and my voice was barely a whisper. I knew I must have cut my lip because I tasted blood. It seemed like hours before they removed the last of the rubble. When the weight was gone, I still didn't feel like I could move. I just looked up into Tony's face and smiled. "David!" Tony shouted in relief. "I was afraid you hadn't survived." "I think I'm okay," I said weakly. "Help me up. Let's see if everything still works." I wanted to get out of there before anything else fell on me. But I soon found out that there wasn't anything left to fall on me. The entire house had been leveled. My body hurt all over. My left arm really ached. Then I realized that the front of my shirt was soaked with blood. I really hate blood. I especially hate it when it's my blood. Angelina had already seen it. She was pulling up my sleeve. She found a gash about 3 inches long on my forearm. Blood was still oozing from the deep cut. I took one look at it, and everything went black. When I opened my eyes, I was back on the ground. Tony was standing over me again. "It'll be all right, David," he was saying. "Angelina will take care of your arm." I struggled to sit up. I was determined to show how brave I was. But when Mrs. Giovanni came to fuss over me, this brave guy felt like crying.
"Hello, David," Mrs. Giovanni said. "It's good to see you again. Tony explained everything. Thank you for saving my family."
I couldn't speak. I just nodded. Tony tore his shirt into strips to make a bandage for my arm. After Angelina wrapped it, it began to feel better. I was finally able to get back on my feet. I took a good look around. I was shocked at the devastation. Every house on the block had been flattened. As far as I could see, in every direction, the damage was tremendous. People were wandering the streets in shock. Their faces were as white as ghosts. Almost everyone was covered with scrapes and bruises. Most of them were still wearing their rumpled pajamas. Their hair was tangled and messy. They were barefooted and had to step carefully over the broken glass on the street. I heard screams a couple of houses away. A mother was shouting that her child was still trapped in the house. She was begging for someone to come help. Tony and I rushed over. We could hear the little boy's cries under the pile of debris. I forgot about my aches and pains and joined in the rescue. We worked carefully to remove the splintered pieces of wood. We threw off the bricks one by one. Finally, we could see the child. As soon as we pulled him free of the rubble, others were calling for help nearby. Tony's family stayed near their home to help injured neighbors. Tony and I went from house to house and offered assistance. We helped some people unbury their loved ones. Others had injuries that needed attention. We uncovered one elderly man still in his bed. His hands were clasped tightly to the mattress.
"The earthquake tossed the bed around," he said. "I felt as if I were riding a wild bull. I just gripped the sides of the mattress and held on."
The aftershocks began less than 15 minutes after the earthquake ended. The tremors were much less powerful, but they were no less frightening. Tony and I continued to help anyone we could. Unfortunately, we found many who could not be helped. In one home, the entire family had been killed. Injured people wandered the streets. Most of them were unsure where to go. Others just stood in the street and watched the chaos. In some areas, the streets were split open. We saw crevices that were over 5 feet deep. Many of the underground water pipes had burst. Water was gushing out, flooding some of the streets. Even underground gas lines had been damaged. Tony explained that the leaky gas was dangerous. A small spark could start a fire.
"Most of the buildings are made of wood," he explained. "If a fire starts, it will be difficult to stop, especially if we have no water pressure."
A large crowd had already gathered at the Brunswick Hotel. The three-story hotel had collapsed. Several of the guests on the third floor had been tossed into the street. Others had fallen three stories through the rubble. The volunteers were searching frantically for the missing. Everywhere we went, the streets were covered with bricks and plaster. The metal frames of some buildings were still standing, but the brick walls had fallen into a heap of scrap. We sat down to rest on the concrete steps of what used to be a bank. Pain clouded Tony's eyes as he stared out over the city.
"It was a beautiful city, David," Tony said sadly, "and I had a good chance of becoming mayor." "Yes, I know you did," I said.
"Are you okay?"
Tony asked with worry in his voice.
"I should have asked earlier. I've been selfish, only thinking of myself."
"I'm fine," I lied. The truth was that I was not fine at all.
"Why did you risk your life to come and warn me?" Tony asked.
He stared hard at me.
"You're my friend," I answered. "I had to come."
"I'll never be able to repay you," Tony said.
"You saved our lives today."
"I'm glad I could do that for you, Tony," I insisted.
"But where is your family?" Tony asked.
"Through all the madness of this morning, I haven't seen them."
"They're not with me," I said, trying to sound brave. "I came alone."
"I'm impressed," he said with real admiration.
"How did you find me?"
"I arrived in Chinatown and made friends with a boy named Chin Lee," I explained. "He helped me find you."
"I want to meet him before you leave," Tony said. "I want to thank him. When do you have to go back home? Do you have to leave from Chinatown?"
I tried to answer him, but I was afraid to speak. I could feel the tears welling up. I cleared my throat, but the words wouldn't come.
"What is it, David?" Tony asked. "Is something wrong?"
"I missed my ride back home, Tony," I said. "I can't ever go back."
Chapter 7. Homesick.
"What are you talking about?" Tony asked. His voice was filled with concern.
"You just go back to the same place where you arrived. I can take you back there."
"It's not that," I said. "Do you remember what I told you when we were in Chicago?"
"I remember your grandfather invented a machine," he said. "You took it to Chicago in 1893, and that's when I met you."
"Yeah, that's right," I agreed. "But remember how we had to be on that sidewalk at a certain time in order to return home?"
"Yes, I remember," he said. "You had to be there at exactly 12.
"That's the problem," I said. "I was supposed to be in Chinatown at 3 a.m. I missed the time."
"But there must be something we can do," Tony insisted.
"There's nothing," I said quietly.
"But what about your parents?" Tony asked. "Won't they come looking for you?"
"No," I said softly.
"Of course they will," he assured me. "They'll come and take you back with them."
"They won't come," I repeated. "They don't know where I am."
"David," Tony said angrily, "you didn't tell anyone where you were going. Why would you do that?"
"They were out of town," I explained. "I was home alone when I found out about you. I thought I could travel back here by myself and help you. Then I planned to return home before they even found out I was gone."
"You didn't tell anyone?" he asked again. "What about your grandmother?"
"I was going to stop and tell her when I was leaving," I said. "But I was afraid she would try to stop me. I decided not to tell her."
Tony had every right to be angry with me. My excuses were weak, and I knew it. The truth was, I had messed up big time.
So I was relieved when Tony reached over and put his arm around my shoulder.
"We'll think of something," he promised. "In the meantime, you can live with my family."
"Thanks, Tony," I said.
As much as I appreciated his offer, I just wanted to go home. But I knew there was nothing else I could do, so I resigned myself to living with Tony.
Of course, my own family has nowhere to live, Tony said with a sigh. But we'll have to fix that. I nodded in agreement. We need to head back and check on them, Tony said. We stood and turned to head back. A dozen different columns of smoke were beginning to curl upward in the distance. That's just what I was afraid of, Tony said. Fires are breaking out everywhere. We have to get back to my family. He was already running toward the bay. I was right behind him. We found that his family hadn't gone far. Mrs. Giovanni was helping an elderly couple gather items from their home. Angelina was tending to the injured. The baby rested on her hip.
Angelina! Tony called.
I'm sorry. We were helping people who were trapped in the wreckage. So many needed help. We were gone too long.
Don't worry, Tony, she said, handing him the baby. We're fine.
We need to gather our things and move out of the area, Tony instructed. Fires have started all over the city. I've heard we can go to Golden Gate Park for refuge, Angelina said. Then we'll head in that direction and see if it's safe, agreed Tony. He called for his mother to join us. We started sifting through the remains of their house. Anything valuable or unbroken would be saved. Tony worked to repair a wagon to carry everything. It was a challenge to find anything that wasn't broken and ruined. Remarkably, I found a few dishes that had survived. We were able to save some family photos, a few silver items, and some bedding and clothing. Angelina found many of the baby's things. She cried, though, when she found a broken piece of mantel clock. It had belonged to her grandmother. Mrs. Giovanni found a Bible with their recorded family history. It had been in a cabinet that now lay splintered on the ground. We loaded everything we could find into the wagon. Amazingly, Tony's horse had not been harmed or frightened away. We hitched him to the wagon. We began our trek away from the area. The fires were closing in behind us. Angelina cried softly because she knew even the remnants of the house would be destroyed by the fire. Tony and I walked alongside the wagon. Tony didn't speak as we walked. He looked straight ahead. His face was set and determined. Other homeless people joined in as we paraded through the burning city. They had carts and wagons filled with personal belongings. Some were forced to drag heavy trunks and suitcases. Even children were weighed down with supplies. Many people were carrying or supporting injured family and friends. I watched in horror as the mass of people moved through the city. I couldn't believe I was really there. It was all so unreal. As we walked, we felt aftershocks every few minutes. Sometimes, when they hit, people would scream in fear. Most of the people headed to parks for shelter. But there were others who headed directly out of town. They swore they would never return to San Francisco. We made our way to Nob Hill to get a better view of the city. A crowd was gathered there. Tony found a good friend from City Hall.
Samuel, Tony called. What have you heard from the mayor?
You know that there were more than 50 fires started by the earthquake, Samuel said. Some were put out by the fire company, but in some areas there was no water to stop the fire. The water mains were broken.
I was afraid of that, Tony said sadly.
There's no water. The fires are raging out of control,
Samuel continued.
They've banded together and become one great wall of flames. Come to the top of the hill and you'll see.
We stood on the slopes of Nod Hill and stared in disbelief. The wall of fire was more than 200 feet high. It glowed a bright red and orange near the bottom. Then there were tall flames of leaping gold toward the sky. Smoke rose for another 2 miles. The wall of flames was moving quickly, devouring everything in its path.
What does the city plan to do to stop the fire? Tony questioned.
They're talking about using dynamite, Samuel answered. They'll try to dynamite a line in hopes the fire can't cross over.
It might work, Tony pondered, but it's going to take a lot of dynamite.
Tony turned his back to the fire and walked away. I followed him and put my hand on his shoulder.
What is it, Tony? I asked. I feel like I should be doing something else to help. His voice was full of frustration. But one person can't stop a fire that size, I tried to tell him. It's better that you and your family are safely away from it.
You're right, Tony agreed. Let's just keep moving.
We joined in with the crowd of refugees once again. We walked for several hours before we reached Golden Gate Park. We found an emergency hospital set up at the main entrance. Makeshift homes and tents were sprawled on the lawn. My heart sank when I thought about this being my new home. My chest ached as I longed for my family. I would have given anything to see my mom, dad, and Jenny right then. I wanted to go home.
Chapter 8. Family Reunion. The park was almost completely filled with refugees. It took us a while to find a spot big enough to park our belongings. We unpacked our few items for cooking. Tony and I tried to set some temporary housing. In spite of the disaster, everyone was friendly and willing to help one another. There were lots of lively stories around the campfire that evening. One man told of buildings that had been on the edge of the bay. He said the earthquake had tossed them right into the water. Others told stories about long lines of railroad cars. They had been thrown off their tracks. Now they lay helpless on the ground. We also discovered that the earthquake had shaken more than just San Francisco. It had reached an area 50 miles south of town. Majestic redwoods that were 200, 300 years old grew there. But they were no match for the earthquake. They had been torn from the ground and left in splinters. Except for the stories, camp life was very boring. Tony and I had to carry buckets of water for cooking and drinking. Angelina and Mrs. Giovanni cooked what little food we had. Without a kitchen stove, they had to stir a simmering pot over an open fire. Tony and I fixed shelter for the women and little Antonio. The two of us had to sleep under the open sky. We rolled up some extra clothing to make a cushion under our heads. That was our only comfort for the night. It was hard to sleep. The heavy smell of smoke hung in the air. Every few hours, the startling sound of dynamite exploded. I was exhausted. I tossed and turned and struggled to find a soft spot on the ground. I had a dream that I was back home in my bedroom. I was wearing my favorite football jersey and playing my new computer game. In my dream, Jenny was calling me to dinner. I could even smell the roast beef. I was on my way downstairs to eat when I heard a loud noise. Then I awakened and realized it was only a dream. The loud noise was another blast of dynamite. I punched the wad of clothing under my head and rolled over. Somehow things had gotten mixed up. Nightmares were supposed to be scary dreams, but now my dreams were good and my real life was a nightmare. I opened my eyes early in the morning. Dark smoke hung around in the air. I was unwilling to get up and face the day, so I quickly closed my eyes and went back to sleep. I hadn't slept long when I heard someone laughing. I refused to open my eyes because I was having another peaceful dream. I was sitting at the kitchen table with my family. We were laughing and playing cards. I fought to stay asleep so I could keep dreaming. But something kept irritating me. The dream faded slowly away. Finally, I opened my eyes. Mrs. Giovanni, Tony, and Angelina were standing over me. Tony was tickling my nose with a blade of grass. I wasn't amused. I sat up angrily, ready to blast them all. But as I sat up, they parted and stepped back. Behind them was the best thing I had ever seen. It was Mom, Dad, and Jenny. I leapt from the ground, grabbing each one. I was sure I was dreaming. They couldn't be real. Before I knew it, they had surrounded me. Then they squeezed me inside a big bear hug. No matter how long I live, I'll always remember that moment.
David, Dad said in a choked voice, I thought we'd lost you.
I'm okay, Dad, I tried to reassure him. I don't know whether to ground you for life
or hug you,
Mom said, smiling.
Hug me first, I said. Then I'll take whatever punishment you think is fair.
Mom hugged me fiercely. I'm sorry, I said quietly. I messed up real bad, and I know it. I don't know why I did such a stupid thing.
We'll have a lot to talk about when we get home, Mom said. She tried to look at me sternly, but a smile broke through. Right now, I'm just glad we found you.
They're going to think up all kinds of punishment for you, Jenny pointed out. And I get to help.
She laughed. I'm not worried, I said. You can't be mean to me.
Oh, yeah? She said, raising her eyebrows. If I were you, I'd start worrying now.
After all I've been through, nothing could be that bad, I told her. Sit down, everybody, Tony invited. We have a lot to catch up on. I sat wedged between my parents with Jenny at my feet. Tony and I explained the whole story. I could tell my parents weren't happy with my decision to come here, but they were obviously proud of what I had done. Mom's face turned white as a sheet when we told about the house collapsing on me. She insisted on removing the bandages and inspecting my arm. She was sure it would leave a nasty scar.
How did you know where to find me? I asked. I couldn't wait to hear how they'd figured out where I was.
Grandma called us and said she and Jenny couldn't find you, Dad started. We called the house several times. When you never answered, we decided we should go home.
When we got home around midnight, there was no sign of you, he continued. We tried to trace what you might have done. We could see you had finished part of the chores. But it was obvious you hadn't cleaned your room yet, Mom said with an eyebrow raised. So we checked to see what else you hadn't finished.
We went into the office and found that you had started on the books, Dad added. It looked like you had stopped in the middle. We couldn't figure out why.
We talked about it for a while, Mom said. We were almost ready to call the police and report you missing. Then we found the book. You left it lying on the desk. It was open to the page about Tony.
Thank goodness I left it open, I sighed.
You're right, Dad agreed. Otherwise, we might never have figured it out.
Once we figured it out, Jenny jumped in, we went to check the time machine. We could tell from the settings what you'd done.
We waited for you to return, Mom said.
When you didn't come back on time, we panicked.
Jenny corrected.
Mom panicked. Dad and I were calm.
Oh, sure, Mom teased. I wasn't the only one prancing around like a maniac.
Well, anyway, we knew there was only one way you could get back, Dad said. We would have to come get you.
But how did you know where I'd be in San Francisco? I asked.
We didn't, Mom said. We walked the streets looking for you. We asked people everywhere if they knew Tony. We tried to find someone who knew where he was, but no one could help us.
We followed a group of refugees into the park late last night, Dad said. Then, early this morning, we started our search in the park.
Actually, Tony found us.
That's right, Tony laughed. I saw them talking to a man at the park's entrance. They were asking if he knew Antonio Giovanni. I stepped up and surprised them.
I'm really sorry for what I put you through, I said.
Somehow, I knew I was going to be saying that for a long, long time.
Chapter 9, An Uncertain Future. I asked happily,
when are we set to return?
Tomorrow night, said Dad.
I wish it were today.
We didn't know how long it would take to find you, Mom explained. We gave ourselves plenty of time. Besides, she added, this way I'll have time to catch up with Francis and Tony. I also want to get acquainted with Angelina and little Antonio.
I wish you could have seen our home, Mrs. Giovanni said. We worked so hard to build it.
We'll build it again, Mama, Tony assured her.
"What have you been doing since you moved here?" Mom asked Mrs. Giovanni.
"I've been working at the university," said Mrs. Giovanni.
"Tony went to school there. When he graduated, he got a good job at the Bank of Italy."
"I work at the bank during the week," Tony added. "On the weekends, I fish for salmon, halibut, and crabs. Then I sell my catch at Fisherman's Wharf."
"Angelina and I met in college," Tony explained. "We were married a few years ago. Antonio was born last year."
"It's amazing," Dad said in awe. "You came to America from Italy and barely spoke English. You've worked hard enough to make your dreams come true."
"Not all of them," Tony interrupted. "I haven't been elected mayor of San Francisco."
"I bet you would have been," I said, "if the earthquake hadn't interrupted the election. Besides, I'm sure there'll be another election."
"Yes, I'm sure there will," Tony said. "But it just won't be the same." He bowed his head sadly.
"Let's let the ladies visit for a while," Dad suggested quietly. "I'd like to take a walk and see what's going on."
"That's a good idea," Tony agreed. "I'd like to check on the fire."
It was the second day of the fire. It didn't seem as if it would ever end. Thick smoke made the day seem dark and bleak. Black ashes floated down from the sky.
We were relieved to see the fire was still a safe distance from Golden Gate Park. Even though the park wasn't very comfortable, at least we weren't in danger.
Most streets didn't have a single building left standing. I started to say it looked as if a nuclear bomb had gone off, but I knew Tony wouldn't have any idea what I was talking about. Everything else was a mess. Piles of rock, lumber, and bricks lay everywhere. I sure was glad I was leaving tomorrow. Cleanup would be starting soon. I sure didn't want to be around for that.
Some cleanup had already started. Streets were being swept clean for relief stations. Workers were setting up rows of tables and benches. Thousands of people would be fed there each day. Temporary kitchens were put together right on the streets to prepare hot stew and bread.
We talked with one of Tony's friends, Randall, who worked for the San Francisco Examiner. He was the first to hear all the news.
"President Roosevelt has been alerted," Randall informed us. "He has already asked that relief be sent as soon as possible."
He told us that Los Angeles was one of the first cities to offer help. They had a trainload of food and medical supplies on the way. They were also sending doctors and nurses.
Randall also reported that supplies were on their way from Colorado, Iowa, and New York. Barges would bring drinking water across the bay. Supplies like flour and potatoes would be given out by the city police force.
"We'll need plenty of help," he said, shaking his head, "especially if the fire continues much longer. It already looks like Chinatown will be completely destroyed."
"Oh, no," I cried. "What about Chin Lee?"
"Where are the Chinese people going?" Tony asked Randall.
"They've scattered," Randall said. "No one wants to take the Chinese in."
Before he could answer any more questions, he was called away.
Dad asked Tony, "Why won't anyone help the Chinese?"
"Chin Lee told me that Chinese and black people are mistreated here," I said.
"He said they aren't allowed in schools and can't get good jobs."
Dad asked Tony, "Is that true?"
"I'm afraid so," Tony said sadly.
"I didn't realize it was like that," Dad said.
"Will it be safe for us to stay in the park with your family tonight?"
"Anyone who has a problem with you has a problem with me," Tony said angrily.
"But I don't want to cause you and your family any trouble," Dad said.
"You know," Tony said slowly, "at first I wanted to be mayor because it was such a distinguished position to hold. But now I realize that if I become mayor, I can work to change things that are wrong in our city. And mistreating anyone because of their skin color is wrong."
We dropped the subject. No one ever mentioned it again. But my family realized that if we had not been with Tony, we would have been treated much differently. It was an uncomfortable thought.
We continued our tour of the city, or what was left of it.
As we walked, Tony pointed out landmarks that were only ruins now. He seemed to get more and more depressed. We finally convinced him that it was time to go back to the park.
"What did you see?" Angelina asked as she greeted us.
"Nothing good," Tony said sadly. "Everything is gone." "We heard news that relief is on the way," Dad offered. "Cities from all over the United States are sending supplies to help out."
"Yes," Mrs. Giovanni agreed. "I heard that food is being handed out in the park this afternoon."
Tony protested. "We've never taken food from anyone. Not even when we first came to America and we were poor."
"It's not the same thing," Mrs. Giovanni said.
"She's right," Dad said sternly. "No one has anything now. Just look around you. Everyone is hungry and homeless."
Angelina offered, "Your mother and I will go for the food."
"You have a beautiful wife and child," Mom said as she watched them walk away.
"Yes," Tony said quietly, "but how will I provide for them? We have no home or money. The bank was destroyed in the earthquake, so now I have no job either."
Everyone was quiet for a moment. Then I could see a spark in Tony's eyes. He had an idea. He turned and looked into Mom's face.
"You can tell me what will happen in the future," he told her. "You must know what will become of us."
"I haven't studied much about San Francisco," Mom said, "but I do know that the city will be completely rebuilt."
"How big will the city be?" Tony asked curiously.
"I was in San Francisco in 1998, Dad said. "Over 700,000 people lived there then."
700,000? Tony said, wide-eyed.
"I do remember something about San Francisco that you'll find interesting," Mom added. "The 1915 World's Fair will be held here, and it will be even more spectacular than the Chicago World's Fair."
"It will happen here in 1915? Tony repeated. "That's only 9 years away."
"San Francisco will be even better than it was," she assured him. "The skyscrapers will be taller. The hotels will be more luxurious. New homes will be built. New businesses will begin."
"And you shouldn't worry about your job," Dad added. "The banks will be very important to rebuilding the city. They'll be one of the first things to be replaced. And you'll have a place to work again in no time."
"That gives me some hope," Tony smiled. "But there's still something you haven't told me," he said. "What will become of me and my family?"
"I can't answer that question," Mom said.
"Why not?" Tony asked, looking confused.
"Because in the history books I studied, you didn't exist. You and your family died in the earthquake of 1906.
Tony stared at her in disbelief. Then he looked slowly at Dad and me.
"I changed the course of history when I saved you all," I said uneasily.
"What does that mean?"
Tony gulped.
"I really don't know," Mom said slowly. "I just know that before this, you didn't exist after 1906. Your family ended there."
"I'm confused," Tony said, shaking his head. "I don't understand what this means for me and my family."
Mom said, "That's what we're trying to tell you. We don't know what it means either. We don't know what will come of you and your family."
Chapter 10. A Dream Come True. After our talk about the future, Tony was very quiet. I wasn't sure how to feel. I knew I felt good about saving their lives, but their future was so uncertain now. And it was my fault. But if I hadn't stepped in, they wouldn't have had any future. I did know that I was ready to go home. The thought of never being able to return home had scared me to death. Now I couldn't get home fast enough. I went to sleep early. I hoped that it would make the time pass faster. When I awoke, the sky was still dark. News came that the fire had almost burned itself out. The people around us cheered. The cleaning and rebuilding could begin soon.
Food was still scarce, but Angelina was able to fix a small breakfast. I ate a little bit to be kind. I was saving my appetite for burgers and fries. Dad had set our return time for 11 p.m. We were leaving from Lafayette Square, where they had arrived. That area was being used as a camp for homeless people, too. Hopefully, everyone would be asleep by that time. We spent every moment with Tony and his family that day. It was sad to know that we would never see them again. Tony asked me to walk around the park with him late in the afternoon. We started out laughing and kidding around. As we walked, his mood changed. "I have a lot to say to you, David," he said, seriously. "I don't even know where to start." I stood, quietly waiting for him to speak. "You saved my life," he said. "And even more important, you saved my family."
"It was..."
I started. "No, let me finish," Tony interrupted. "I have no way to pay you back, but I want to tell you how important you are to me."
"When we met in Chicago," he continued, "you were my first real American friend. But now, you are even more. More than I can explain."
"You don't have to say anything," I tried to tell him.
"You and your family will live in our hearts forever."
I felt the same, but I hated all that mushy stuff. I needed to lighten the mood.
"Just chill," I said in my deepest voice. "It's cool, man. You know you're an awesome dude."
Tony threw his head back and laughed loudly.
"You and your new American words," he chuckled.
He slung his arm over my shoulder. We walked back to camp, slowly. The sun was just going down when we arrived. My family refused to join them for dinner. We insisted that they keep the food for themselves. We said goodbye to Mrs. Giovanni, Angelina, and little Antonio in the park. Then Tony escorted us to Lafayette Park. We had just started the long walk to the square when I heard someone call out my name. I recognized the voice immediately. It was Chin Lee. I turned to see him running towards us.
"David," he called as he neared me. "You're all right."
"Yes," I told him. "I'm fine. And I found my friend in time."
"I'm very pleased for you," he said, grinning. "I also warned my grandmother in time. We were safe from the earthquake."
"That's great," I said. I introduced Chin Lee to everyone.
"Chin Lee," Tony said, "I'm very grateful for your help. If you and your grandmother need anything, you must let me know."
"Thank you very much," Chin Lee said as he bowed. "When I start fishing again, I'll need a worker on the boat," Tony said, smiling. "Someone just about your size," he said as he held his hand flat over Chin Lee's head. Everyone laughed. Chin Lee grinned wildly.
"I'll go and tell my grandmother," he said happily. "She'll be very proud."
He bowed quickly once again, then he turned and dashed away. Just as we had suspected, we found a crowd of people in Lafayette Square. Very few of them were still awake, though. Dad quietly led us to an area next to the fountain. I had a hard time saying goodbye to Tony. We had become even closer on this trip. I tried to think of home in order to make it easier to leave him. We were on the right spot at exactly 11. We felt the familiar movement. It scared me at first. It almost felt like another earthquake. I was relieved when I realized we were quickly spinning on our own way through time. The lights and colors were comforting as they spun around me. I relaxed and floated through time like an experienced time traveler. The motion stopped, and we were magically in the time machine once again. What a beautiful sight it was. I wanted to kiss that machine for bringing me home. But, of course, that wouldn't be cool. Grandma was waiting for us. She grabbed me as soon as I walked out the door. First she hugged me. Then she fussed at me.
"David Smithers," she said, "I can't believe you'd go off and do such a foolish thing. You almost scared an old woman to death."
"I'm sorry, Grandma," I said. "I shouldn't have taken off like that." "We're going to talk about that when we get home,"
Dad said sternly.
Ooh, Jenny teased. David's going to be in trouble.
I was so excited to be back that I didn't even care about being in trouble. Dad stopped and picked up hamburgers, fries, and milkshakes on the way home. Everyone was quiet while we ate dinner. I wasn't sure if they were tired or really mad. I decided I'd better stay quiet, too. Dad pushed himself away from the table when he had finished eating. He looked at me. Well, what do you have to say for yourself, David? He asked. I decided it would be better if I just admitted I'd messed up. I wasn't even going to try to get out of it. I made the wrong decision, Dad, I said. When I found out about Tony, I reacted without thinking.
And? Dad waited for me to continue.
I should never have tried time travel alone. I'll never do it again, I promised.
And?
Dad prompted. And when you leave me in charge, I'll stay in the house and get all of my chores done.
Okay, he agreed. But I don't think we'll be leaving you in charge again for a long time.
I figured that, I said quietly. I don't know what happened. I was just upset about Tony. Then I started making all the wrong decisions about how to help him. I should have told you about it. We could have all gone together.
Yes, Dad agreed. You're not old enough to make decisions like that. That's what your mother and I are for.
I know, I mumbled.
Your mother and I have decided that you will be grounded for a month, Dad said sharply. You'll have a list of chores to do every Saturday morning around the house. Then you'll have chores at Grandma's house on Saturday afternoons.
School starts in 2 weeks, he continued. You'll come straight home from school every day until your month is up. Your homework is to be done by 8 o'clock.
Okay, I agreed quietly.
You also didn't finish the things on your list, Mom pointed out.
She handed me the list from Saturday morning. You need to finish my office and clean your room.
Yes, Mom, I said as I headed for the office.
One more thing, David, Dad said.
Yes? I asked.
I'm proud of you, he said softly. Wanting to help Tony shows that you have a good heart, and it was brave of you to try to do it alone.
I smiled at his compliment.
Not very wise, Dad added, but very brave.
Jenny followed me into the office.
I'll help you, David, Jenny offered.
Thanks, Jenny, I smiled. I knew she'd have trouble being mean.
The boxes of books were piled where I had left them. The San Francisco book was still lying open on the desk. I picked it up and scanned the page with the article about the mayoral election. I was so shocked, I almost dropped the book. I ran into the kitchen with Jenny close behind. I pushed the book in front of Mom and Dad.
You have to read this, I yelled. Everything has changed.
I pointed to the article as Dad began to read it aloud. The mayoral election was postponed due to the earthquake. When the election was finally held, Mayor Schmitz was soundly defeated by newcomer Antonio Giovanni. Mayor Giovanni continued to hold office for 4 terms. He was one of San Francisco's most beloved mayors.
You really did it, Mom exclaimed. Mayor Giovanni, I repeated proudly.
Tony's dream had come true.